SEC fans, welcome to the Saturday Down South podcast. Coming to you from the iHeartMedia studio, WDAE in Tampa, Florida, 620 AM and 95.3 FM. My name is John Crist, senior writer for Saturday Down South. His name is Connor O'Gara, national columnist for Saturday Down South. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at SaturdayJC. You can also follow him at CJ O'Gara. So, Connor, just another week in the SEC. How's it going for you?
Life is good. Life is good. We're getting to that point where I kind of just want football to start. I'm about ready. I'm about sick of all the preseason quotes. Let's just get this thing going.
Yeah, I agree. We're teased with media days, and then you forget it's still about 6 weeks until we actually put toe to leather. But before we get too deep into the conversation, remember the Saturday Down South podcast is brought to you by our friends at Ticket City. College football is on the horizon. There are some major SEC matchups coming at us. Alabama, Florida State, Michigan, Florida, Georgia, Notre Dame. I'm going to that one, by the way. Can't wait. Now's the time to get your tickets. We've been working with Ticket City for a long time. They are the experts in the field. They've served 1.5 million customers to date. They're the place to go, and they have been for 30-plus years. They are offering $20 off for all of our podcast listeners. All you have to do is go to TicketCity.com and enter the discount code SDS20. At checkout, you're going to save $20 on the game of your choice. Again, that's TicketCity.com, discount code SDS20. Let's go ahead and start off on the plains, if we will, Connor. And you wrote something pretty interesting this week, sort of a contrarian take, if you will, based on what's happening with the national conversation. But Jarrett Stidham, the worst-kept secret in the SEC, officially named the starting quarterback by Tigers coach Gus Malzahn. A lot of people are over the moon with expectations, some even putting him on Heisman Trophy watch lists. Maybe the Tigers competitors for the college football playoff and knocking off Big Al in the West. But you want everybody just to kind of slow their roll a little bit. What's your rationale?
Let's all take it easy, take a deep breath, and realize this kid has 3 career starts. I understand we like the hype. We love it when a kid comes out of a place like Texas and has this big arm and is a blue-chip recruit, and he's everything that Auburn needs. But it's 3 career starts. It's a guy that hasn't played football against a live defense since 2015, and it's a guy with 3 career starts. So that's the biggest thing that I keep coming back to with Stidham is, yeah, everything that you're going to hear about him is positive. All the tools are there. But there's a learning curve that comes with this, and I don't care how many defenses he lit up playing Texas high school football. It's a different ball game in the SEC, and we're going to see how far along he is at this stage of his career because he needs reps, in my opinion. And you know, based on some of the reports that have come out of camp too, he's not a finished product. I mean, this guy is still relatively young. And there are still some things that he's going to, you know, have to work through, and it's going to be really interesting to see where he's at come week 2 against Clemson. But I just want everybody to kind of slow their roll because I don't think it's fair that he should be 5th in the Heisman odds tied with guys like Saquon Barkley and Jake Browning and DeAndre Francois. Like, I'm not there yet. Now, if he beats Clemson, of course, you know, that conversation changes. But let's just all take a chill pill on the Stidham hype.
Connor, I love the idea that you and I are on the same page way too much. But I love that we can sort of fight on this one because I've been writing all offseason that if you've got some Jarrett Stidham stock to sell, I'm happy to buy it and take it straight to the bank because I think he's the most important addition in the entire conference. And you're right. He comes from Baylor, that air raid approach, which can certainly inflate some numbers. I'm not going to sit here on the show and try to convince anybody that the Big 12 defense is anything like the SEC defense Saturday after Saturday. But you mentioned 3 starts. Let's look at the numbers from those 3 starts. As a freshman, by the way, at Kansas State, very first time he starts a game, he throws for 419 yards, 3 touchdowns, no picks. A week later, Oklahoma at home. Oklahoma was number 5 in the country, by the way, when that game was played. 257 yards, 2 touchdowns. Yes, he was picked off twice and they lost that game, but not a bad performance. A week later, at Oklahoma State, ranked 20th at the time. We know the Cowboys can score. You've got to outscore Mike Gundy, and he did that. 258 yards passing, 1 touchdown. He was not picked off. He got injured after that, and that was the season. He put in his papers, JUCO, and here he is at Auburn. Yes, he only has 3 career starts, but let's talk about the fact that this Auburn program was over the moon to bring in John Franklin III 12 months ago. He couldn't start at the JUCO level. This is a guy in Stidham who put up some serious numbers. I think he's going to be an incredible difference maker for Gus Malzahn's offense.
Yeah, and just to back up, I'm a believer. Like, I think he's going to be a really good quarterback in this offense. I'm just not sold on the Heisman hype and that he's all of a sudden just going to be this star from the jump. I think there's a learning curve. I think he's a much better quarterback at season's end than he is in September. But just to back up real quick, you talk about those three games that he played against, that he played against actual college competition. Kansas State ranked 120th in the pass that year. Oklahoma, 34th against the pass. Okay, pretty good, but he still lost against them. It's a loss is a loss. 16 of 27 passing. He didn't light them up exactly. Oklahoma State, 94th against the pass, 88th scoring defense. So it's not like he was facing these gauntlet defenses that he's going to see in the SEC this year. And so that's, to me, I don't want to get worked up about his numbers in such a small sample size, because as we know, it's also tough for a defense if there's no book on a kid too. And that's going to be the interesting thing, is once there's a book on him and there's a large enough sample size, how is he going to adjust? How is he going to learn how to be able to kind of account for what defense are going to expect out of him? Is he going to be willing to take that check down? Is he going to be willing to not go for the home run play all the time? There's still that learning curve that's there. And yes, I agree 100% that if this works and if he's the star, the sky's the limit for Auburn. They're the best competition for Alabama in this division, in this conference, if it all works out. But it's still an if, and it's not a surefire thing. And that's just what I kind of want people to just slow down a little bit with.
Well, there's a reason why I'm high on this addition and I'm high on this team. I don't know if they're going to compete with Alabama and what they have going on there. That's quite a quantum leap. But yes, he does have experience. We're not talking about a JUCO kid who put up, video game numbers at Last Chance U. He's not making a jump from the FCS level and someone's telling me about what he did at Charleston Southern or something like that. It was Baylor. It was the Big 12. It was a very 21st century passing attack. Not to mention the fact that he goes to Gus Malzahn, and this is a guy, I don't think Stidham's going to be asked to throw the ball 35 or 40 or 45 times a game. Let's not forget that Gus Malzahn's mantra is run the ball and run it with pace. He will pound it between the tackles time after time, and he won't throw it unless it's absolutely necessary. He's got Cameron Petway in the backfield. He's got Kerryon Johnson in the backfield. That's the best 1-2 punch in the league, hands down. It's not Damian Harris and Bo Scarborough at Alabama. It's not Nick Chubb and Sony Michel at Georgia. It's Petway and Johnson, an incredible, incredible 1-2 punch. That's going to take so much pressure off of Stidham, and vice versa. It works the other way around. Look at what Johnson and Petway did last year with guys like JF3 and Sean White and Jeremy Johnson pulling the trigger. Very limited passers. Those safeties are creeping down into the box, and they still ran it down most everyone's throats. If those safeties still cheat up, Stidham showed it in the spring game. He's got more than enough arm to deliver some dimes down the field. Now all of a sudden, those safeties are on their heels a little bit. Those corners are playing 8-9 yards off the ball, no bump and run type stuff. Linebackers are thinking about dropping into their zones, not filling gaps. Just imagine the running room for Petway and Johnson. I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful marriage, and I can't wait to see it.
It could be a great marriage. You're exactly right, and all those things could happen. And for the record, just to keep Auburn fans out of my mention,
good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with that, exactly. I put Auburn at number 12 in my preseason top 25, so it's not like I'm down on the Tigers by any stretch of the imagination. I think the offense should be improved. I just remember hearing so much Jeremy Johnson hype, and it's not that Stidham is the same quarterback as Jeremy Johnson. It's, can he succeed in a Gus Malzahn offense? Is Gus Malzahn's offense catered for a quarterback to succeed, to thrive, to maximize his skill set? Is he going to be asked and put in position to make those big-time throws? That's a question I have, too, and I think time will tell. We're going to see how this thing plays out, very early on with that Clemson matchup. But I'm not ready to kind of jump, feet first in yet. I'm just kind of waiting to see that first big sign that, okay, this kid is the real deal. We can get excited about him. We fall in love with transfers. We fall in love with these with big time recruits, and I want a bigger sample size. If he shows in those, you know, even in the first month of the season, if he shows, all right, I'm legit. I'm slinging the ball all over the place. I'll be right there, you know, willing to board the Stidham bandwagon. I'm taking my time getting on. That's all.
Now, I got to say, that was the best point you've made yet in this argument. I'm clearly winning the argument, but that was the best point you made yet. Is this an oil and water situation? Because let's look at this offense since Malzahn got back to the Plains in 2013. He prefers a mobile guy. He likes to have a running threat at quarterback. Nick Marshall was a converted corner. Let's not forget that. He goes off to the NFL, and pro scouts take one look at him and say, young man, put down the ball. Please go back to the secondary. That's where you belong. Jeremy Johnson, look, that's the easy argument for all non-Auburn fans to make is Jeremy Johnson, Heisman candidate. Clearly, he was a bust on the recruiting trail. Let's just move on from that argument. JF3, he's a wide receiver. He thinks he's a quarterback. But the guy I want to bring up is Shaun White. He is a pocket passer, mediocre talent, average size, you know, sort of a low ceiling, high floor type of guy. But even when he was going well last year, when Auburn got on that nice little run in October, November, you still saw Shaun White doing read option type stuff and doing some keepers off the edge. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me. That's clearly not his game. I know that's Malzahn's offense, but that could be one thing where the hurdle doesn't get jumped, where he's got this drop back passer with the big arm, but all of a sudden he's doing this read option stuff. And A, that's not what he does well. And B, you open him up to injury. Auburn's season started to go down the tank in November when Shaun White banged up that shoulder. You can't have him doing things that he doesn't do well. So will Malzahn be stubborn and force him into his system, or will he open things up a little bit and cater to the new talent that he has?
I'm looking forward, though. So I'm picturing the future headline after Stidham throws like five touchdown passes in the first game against Georgia Southern, and they get that Clemson game coming up, and it's game day, and there's all these stories about you know how great of a fit this is, and all these things that are going to suggest that Stidham is just ready to be this star in college football, and ready to put him on all of our Heisman ballots. And he goes into Clemson, and it's just like, all right, these are men that he's playing against on defense. This is a little bit more difficult than maybe we've been giving this whole transition process credit for. So I don't know. I the sky is the limit with Auburn. I will agree with that 100%. But, you know, I've heard it before with a Malzahn quarterback, and I'm just waiting to see how this thing plays out.
Yeah, I agree. But again, let's take a snapshot of those Malzahn quarterbacks. Marshall, he's really a DB. He's not a quarterback. Sure. Johnson, a lot of hype coming in. Some guys just don't have it. The stories that I've heard off the record primarily is just, you know what? He was a little bit jittery. He was a little bit nervous. He was afraid of the big stage. And when things got tight, that's when he made mistakes. You know, John Franklin III, just rewatch season one of Last Chance U. You know why he didn't work out. White, again, tough kid, like watching him play, but just a limited ceiling. This is a different animal. This isn't even apples and oranges. This is apples and orangutans. I think that Stidham is that much better. And if you look at what this passing game has done the last couple of years, I've written it 100 times. It's just Malzahn has been holding it together with duct tape and bubble gum. It's all screens. It's all predetermined throws. It's all east-west. It's all read option gimmicky type stuff. Now he has a guy who can throw the corner fade. Now he's got a guy who can throw a 20-yard out on a dime. Now he's got a guy who can hit those digs across the middle, those post corners, and deliver it on a rope. He didn't have that before. Now he has that. And he's also got a young group of receivers. Almost all of them are back from a year ago. Those are guys who haven't had a chance to make a whole lot of plays. There's not a lot of tape on them. It wouldn't surprise me at all if guys like Nate Craig Myers and Ryan Davis and Marcus Davis and Eli Stove, they become stars in this league because they never had a chance before catching it from the guys they had previously.
One more question, then we can move on. Do you have apples to orangutans trademarked, or is that still available?
Feel free to put it out there. Just give me that 10% finder's fee.
We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that later. I'll concede this argument for now. You made some good points, and I'm willing to believe in Stidham. I'm willing to get on that hype train. Just You know, if the things that you say play out in the first few weeks of the season, I'll be all in there. But, you know, let's see where the chips fall.
You are learning, my friend. You are learning. Topic two, let's go to the other side of the Yellowhammer State and Alabama, the Crimson Tide, of course, always a topic of conversation. I got handed an assignment, and I put it up yesterday. The 10 most important people in Alabama's decade-long dynasty, trying to rank them from 10 to 1. The hardest thing was just coming up with 10 names. I mean, the cutting room floor, you can't see the floor anymore because there's just too many names and faces on it. I was kind enough to be asked to go on the Paul Feinbaum show and talk about this thing. Got an incredible amount of traffic on Twitter and the like because it's a list and everybody loves to talk about a list. The problem is I got 10 names on this list and I got 50 suggestions for who should be on it on top of that, but I didn't get a lot of ideas on who would come off. Everyone will give me four or five names that I'm a moron for not including, but they won't tell you who shouldn't be on this list. So very quickly, 10 to 1, Terrence Cody, Rolando McClain, Mark Ingram, Scott Cochran, the incomparable strength and conditioning coach, Lane Kiffin, Kirby Smart, AJ McCarron, Julio Jones, number two, Mal Moore, the legendary late athletic director who made the Nick Saban hire in the first place, and, of course, the man himself, Nick Saban. So any compliments, any commentary, any criticism, go for it.
I think you should have not put Saban at number one. No, I'm kidding. I would have loved to have seen your mentions if you had not put Saban at number one. It's a good list. It's a good list. It's an impossible list to come up with in the way for the reasons that you just mentioned. There are so many other guys that could have cracked this list. A lot of people, I'm sure, were throwing the Derrick Henry at you. That's a little bit of recency bias, but there are so many other names that could have made the cut. I know you were campaigning a little bit for Greg McElroy, guys like Barrett Jones that have been so huge for this program in the last decade here. But I think that I'm okay with it. I mean, I kind of looked it over, and maybe I would have shuffled a few things around. You were higher on Julio than I thought you would be. I get that Julio is the first big-time recruit, but I just thought from kind of a production standpoint, I'm not denying Julio's credentials. Unreal player. But for him to be the most significant Alabama player in the last decade, I think that's saying a lot. Did you get any kind of flack for Julio at three?
I didn't get any flack for Julio on the list. Of course, there's people saying that some people should be higher or lower. But I think I can make a pretty strong argument for why Julio Jones is the top player on the list, and he's ahead of guys like Kirby Smart. A lot of people wanted to give him love. An incredible amount of support for Scott Cochran. People who know this program know how important he is from a strength and conditioning perspective. There's a reason why Alabama is bigger, faster, and stronger than every team in the country, and it's Mr. Cochran, what he does in the weight room. But as far as Julio Jones is concerned, as you alluded to, he was really the first five-star get on the recruiting trail for Saban, part of the class of 2008. He comes in. He's the leading receiver right away, 900-plus yards, set a freshman record, which has since been broken by Calvin Ridley, I believe. But then, you know, he's on that national championship team in 2009. I know his numbers weren't gaudy, but there was no question he was a big reason why guys like Mark Ingram and Trent Richardson had holes to run through because you couldn't cover that guy one-on-one downfield. 2010, he puts together a sensational season, 1,100-plus yards, 7 touchdowns. Those aren't video game numbers, but you have to remember, this is Alabama we're talking about. This is historically a 3 yards and a cloud of dust program. This is a traditional run-the-eye, off-tackle type of program. Now all of a sudden you've got this wide receiver out there, a physical freak, winning one-on-one matchups, taking away 50-50 balls, and he goes in the top 10 in the draft, and you make an argument right now, he's the best wide receiver in the NFL. I think that he was patient zero for this program at that position. They didn't have guys like this at Alabama until he got there. All of a sudden the floodgates open, and then here comes Amari Cooper from South Florida. He doesn't go to the Hurricanes. He doesn't go to the Gators. He doesn't go to the Seminoles. After him, here comes Calvin Ridley. Same part of the country. Here comes Jerry Jeudy. Did you watch the spring game? He looks like Julio Jones part two. So I think that he sort of parted the Red Sea, if you will, and all these pass catchers come behind him. If he doesn't go there, maybe Amari Cooper stays home, goes to Miami, and he catches a bunch of balls for a couple of 8-4 teams. That's just my prediction. not my prediction per se, but that's why I think Jones was so important for that program, for that position, and completely changed offensively how we look at the Crimson Tide.
That's a fair point. I think that's what some people maybe struggle with, is the list is ranking the 10 most important people in Alabama.
It's not best players. That's most important, most influential. Exactly.
Right. Yeah, and so there are going to be people that have probably thrown stats at you about, you know, this player ran for this many yards, and I could, you know, we could talk about Julio stats and stuff like that, but you're right in that he is significant from that standpoint. And I think somebody that, statistically speaking, doesn't get enough love is A.J. McCarron. I get how decorated he was, but I think nationally speaking, there are a lot of people that just kind of assume he was a system quarterback, and I just don't think that was fair. Looking back at some of his numbers, I mean, 175.3 passer efficiency rating, best in the country, just incredible numbers, 30-3 touchdown to interception ratio. I mean, the guy was a stud. Yeah, he had an incredible running game to work with. He had an offensive line that could have blocked for anybody, but the guy's got to make big-time throws, and he did on so many occasions for that team. And I think having him at number four might have surprised some people, but I think that's a fair spot. And I think even you were a little bit down on him at first when we were trying to, you know, you did the heavy lifting coming up with this list, but when we were kind of, you know, throwing some names around, I don't know if you were quite as high on McCarron, and I thought you were kind of hinting at McElroy getting some more love.
Yeah, I was actually sort of a late arriver to McCarron, and the closer I looked at the situation and talked to some people in the know, it just made more sense not only to include him, but to get him way up on this list. And originally, I did have Greg McElroy instead of A.J. McCarron, in part because, you know, McElroy was a three-star kid from Texas versus McCarron, who was a four-star kid from the Mobile area. I just liked the story McElroy could tell about not being a Nick Saban recruit. You know, he was brought in by Coach Shula, but by Mike Shula. He wasn't a Saban guy, but he didn't be like your typical 21st century quarterback and pack up and transfer and, you know, this isn't my coach and let me go play somewhere else. He stuck it out. He liked what he heard. Obviously, it's a pretty easy sell when Nick Saban walks in the door instead of Mike Shula. I can't deny that. But he was that system quarterback. And I sort of re-looked at the numbers, and that national championship he won in 2009, that national championship game, he threw 11 passes. I know that he didn't need to do a heck of a lot more because Mark Ingram is running all over the place and Trent Richardson is having a pretty good supplementary day and the defense was positively suffocating, not to mention the fact that Colt McCoy from Texas gets hurt real early and that just completely changed the game. You don't want to make any mistakes. But A.J. McCarron put up some big numbers. I mean, that season you referenced, 30 touchdown passes, only 3 picks. I don't care what system you're in, that is not a mistake. That's a guy who's got a big-time arm and makes some big-time throws. And not only did he win one national championship, he won two. He came within spitting distance of a third. So, yeah, I was a little bit late to the McCarron party. But, hey, he's still sticking around the NFL. People are offering draft picks to go get him. The Bengals hold on to him because they see the value. So I think he's a really good player, an underrated player. And even I am just now realizing just how underrated he probably is in the grand scheme of things.
Enough, I think people would be surprised to see that three of the top six guys on this list were there for Alabama's passing exploits. If you had, we talk about McCarron and Julio at 3 and 4, or at 4 and 3, and then you had Kiffin at number 6. And I think there are some people that look at Kiffin and think, wow, only one spot behind Kirby Smart. Kirby Smart was there for 7 years, and Kiffin was there for 3 seasons, and the way he went out was kind of awkward and all that stuff. But you bring up a very good point about Kiffin and that he kind of brought Saban into this 21st century offense where he allowed him to rethink his total offensive mindset in terms of what's important, how to catch teams off balance, because, you know, let's face it, for the majority of his time at Alabama, Nick Saban has been able to say, my best is better than your best, and we're going to beat you at the line of scrimmage. We have better tailbacks than you, and that's how we're going to win the game. We're going to make key third down throws, and that's all she wrote. And Kiffin just kind of changed that whole approach. I remember going into that Cotton Bowl thinking, after the 2015 season that is against Michigan State, thinking, you know what, Michigan State's got a chance. Michigan State has a ton of future pros on this defense. This is a team that is, you know, they shut down Ezekiel Elliott. I think that they can, you know, do some things against Derrick Henry. And then Bama just blew them off the doors. And that was all Chris Kiffin. And I don't think that anybody nationally really expected him to come out and throw the ball the way they did in the Cotton Bowl. But it was, I mean, pretty much from the middle of the second quarter on, it was pure domination. And it was maybe Kiffin's best moment at Alabama, in my opinion. Just a total 360 game plan that he threw at a very well-coached Michigan State team. And it was kind of just, you know, you look back on little things like that that Kiffin did, and you're just like, wow, this guy was incredibly smart. For all the off-the-field stuff and, you know, the quirkiness of, you know, the way that he uses social media now, that gets a lot of attention, but he was an incredible football coach and somebody that Bama desperately needed in the beginning of this playoff era.
You know, I had a couple people on social media and the like say some silly things like, why is Lane Kiffin on the list? He only has one national championship. You know, why don't you put Jim McElwain on there? He had two national championships on that program. This isn't simple arithmetic. This is calculus, and even deeper than that. You have to find ways to go a little deeper than just the actual numbers. And yes, Jim McElwain was on that staff, and he's a very important part of it. It's one of the reasons why he's the head coach at a blue blood program like Florida right now. But I'm asking you, Connor, give me one moment you remember from the Jim McElwain era offensively in Tuscaloosa. Nothing really jumps out at you, but you can name half a dozen from Lane Kiffin. And that Michigan State game is a perfect reference point because that was a very good defense. As you said, they had a couple of pass rushers who were very good. They had a couple of corners who were very good, getting paid to play right now. But the first half of that game, when they started to find their footing, all of a sudden, Jake Coker, by the way, a transfer quarterback who's not going to ever take a snap in the NFL, is just delivering dimes down the field to Calvin Ridley, making huge plays. And then when you build up that lead in the first half, now here comes the Heisman Trophy winner, and it's Derrick Henry just bludgeoning them to death between the tackles, play after play after play. And it really was masterful to watch. It wasn't a competitive game. I really thought it was going to be, but that was a signature moment for Kiffin. And all I really need to know about the Kiffin era, as explosive as it was, as combative as it was at time with Coach Saban, I think a lot of people said good riddance when he took that FAU job. But Brian Daboll comes in as the new offensive coordinator from the NFL ranks, and he's not bringing a pro-style offense. He's not bringing this tight end-friendly offense because he worked with Rob Gronkowski for the New England Patriots. He was basically told, hey, what we were doing before with Jalen Hurts, keep doing that. We want hurry up. We want spread. We want as many snaps as possible. We're playing 21st century offense. Just because Saban brings in an NFL guy doesn't mean he's going back to line him up between the tackles, I formation, tight end heavy, old school offense. It's still going to be go, go, go as many snaps as possible. It's Lane Kiffin who brought Nick Saban to that way of thinking. I don't know if anybody else could have done it.
So that's basically your way of saying if Bama wins the national title this year, that Saban is going to go back and give Lane Kiffin a championship ring, and they'll probably hug it out, have a nice public moment. I don't know, maybe take a couple photos for you know all the cameramen. It's just going to be a great sight to see. That's essentially what you're saying, is that Saban loves Kiffin and that this relationship that they've built is going to be felt years and years down the road, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and I'm also anticipating 5 minutes after he gets said ring that Lane Kiffin will put it on eBay and tweet out a photo of the advertisement.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, wouldn't you do that?
It's probably worth a lot of money with a bunch of diamonds in it. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, what's he going to want? He can't wear that around FAU. I mean, they're, you know... He's all about FAU. I love how he's using the Miami thing to market his own program, but that's a different subject for a different time.
Now I have to admit, there's one name that I thought about putting on this list. I couldn't quite find room. I actually was going to make it a sidebar in addition to the story and just sort of, you know, you need 25 hours in every 24 days sometimes. But I thought a very interesting addition to this list. How about Terry Saban and Nick Saban's wife? I think she is a huge component of what's happened in the last decade plus with the Crimson Tide. I think she gets a lot of credit for him landing that job in the first place. It's no secret that she wasn't a big fan of the NFL lifestyle, of the big city lifestyle. She preferred the small town Southern way. She preferred the collegiate environment. And for the first time, Nick Saban laid down some roots and became a part of the community. And he's expected to be there for quite some time. We're to the point now, I can't see him taking another job. And sure, his agent is going to throw some rumors out there with the Dallas Cowboys and the Indianapolis Colts and whatever else goes out there, because he gets him a fresh contract extension every single January. But I don't think Saban's going anywhere until he decides to hang up his whistle. I think Terry Saban has a lot to do with that. She is a giant in that community, and she is the first lady of football for the Crimson Tide. I couldn't find a place to put her on the list, but anybody who complained, I basically nodded my head and said, yeah, you got a point.
That's a fair point. Behind every great coach is usually a great wife and
usually
somebody that has been there. I mean, a lot of the great coaches in college football history have given so much credit to their wives. I know with Urban Meyer, that's been such a, you know, Shelly Meyer has been such a big ambassador, both at Florida and now at Ohio State.
Well, she did save him from that heart attack. You got to give her that.
That's true. So there are elements there that I think kind of go overlooked, and I think you'll get people that say, oh, well, how many games has she won, blah, blah, blah. But you're right in that this is a list of most important people. And, you know, without her, is Nick Saban the person that he is? I don't know. I don't know if he's able to have the longevity and the patience for some of the things that he goes through on a day-to-day basis. So, I think you could definitely make an argument for that.
All right, last topic for today's show. It was the third birthday this week for SEC Network. It's been a very quick 3 years, but it sort of got me thinking about just the networks as a whole at college football. That's one of the things separating the haves from the have-nots right now. And I know we talk about the Power Five conferences, of course, the SEC, Big Ten, ACC, Big 12, and Pac-12, but there's even some separation within the Power Five right now. And I believe that the conference affiliations and the television affiliations with those conferences is a big reason why. The SEC Network is a smashing success, an absolute cash cow for every school in that league. I think they do a very good job from a programming perspective. They have some very smart people who are very tight on television, clearly enjoy working with each other. The Paul Feinbaum show has exploded from what it once was, you know, regionally. Now it's become a national program. I don't know how many listeners there are in California necessarily, but clearly it's gone to the next level. I think they do a sensational job. I don't live in Chicago anymore, so I don't get a chance to see a ton of Big Ten Network, but I was interested in sort of a compare and contrast between the two and just the state of conference networks as a whole where we are right now.
It kind of blows my mind that the Big Ten Network came so much earlier than the SEC Network, because really, if you look at the history of the way that this all kind of came to be, Jim Delaney threw this idea at ESPN essentially 13 years ago in 2004 when the new TV deal was up and they were negotiating, and he basically told ESPN, I'm not going to accept that offer and I'm just going to go start my own TV network and I'm going to drive all these TV rights prices up, watch me. And then, of course, that's what he did. 3 years later, Big Ten Network launches and everybody else is in a rush to follow suit. And it's amazing that it took as long as it did for the SEC Network to get going, because everybody knew it was going to be a success. I mean, let's be honest. Who wouldn't want to sit there and just, you know, watch SEC programming all day, every day? I mean, it was a no-brainer that this thing was going to take off and it was going to be incredibly beneficial for these schools. I mean, now you have teams in the Big Ten are going to be getting upwards of $50 million with these new TV contracts. I mean, the Big Ten just agreed to a $2.64 billion deal over 6 years.
Wow.
And that's thanks in large part to the Big Ten Network and what it's been able to do to these rights fees. And the SEC Network has followed very quickly and built up quicker than the Big Ten Network did, absolutely. And it's going to be interesting to see the way that these networks kind of all develop and how they're able to kind of maximize the profitability of it. Because the Big 12, let's be honest, missed the boat on this. And, you know, the Big Ten and the SEC are cash cows right now, and they have these big TV networks to thank for it.
But think about it this way. Despite the fact that both those networks have done so incredibly well the Big Ten Network over a longer period of time, SEC Network a much shorter window. Why can't they make this work in the Big 12? Why can't the Pac-12 Network truly get off the ground? Because you know what? The wrong time of year when you turn on the SEC Network, you're watching, you know, some track and field, or you're watching, you know, a middle-of-the-road volleyball game, or some softball here and there. And I don't think it's an insult to say that that doesn't quite have the gravitas of even a rerun of a good football game that was played 4 months prior. So they're starving for programming. And it's not like it's a greatest hit show 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's really not. Football season, when you have that insatiable appetite, it can't be beat. But in the offseason, again, some mediocre programming, they really have to fill the airwaves 24 hours a day. But I don't understand why it doesn't work as well at other places. Of course, you can make the argument that in the SEC, sure, the fans are a little more passionate, and the professional sports influence isn't quite there, doesn't have the history, doesn't have the footprint. And you know what? Frankly, maybe there's just a lot less to do than there is in places like the California area or the Texas area. But I still find it hard to believe that the Big 12 can't make this work. I find it hard to believe that the Pac-12 Network can't get on more channels and can't get on more networks and can't get on more television sets at home. Is the SEC programming that much better, or is just the way they've gone about it worked when the others didn't?
Well, I think part of it is the Big Ten and SEC Network have both they've thrived on having just the right on-air personalities and just the right vision behind what they're trying to do. I think they have both been able to benefit from great on-air programming. They do some other things that are maybe a little bit different than what they thought they would be doing in terms of some of the live campus shows and stuff like that. And I think that stuff's great. I mean, shoot, College Game Day does it all the time. And why wouldn't, you know, Big Ten Network have a live show, a live tailgate show where they're on a campus on a Saturday? And same thing with the SEC Network. I mean, so they've been able to kind of capitalize on doing things like that, where I think the other conferences are just kind of behind the eight ball. They're just kind of they were slow to adapt to the TV movement, and the Longhorn Network probably had a big thing to do with that, and it sort of limited what the Big 12 was able to do. But we're seeing the effects of it right now, and I question how conferences that don't have thriving, successful networks are going to be able to continue to grow, and I question how they're going to, you know, continue to keep up with the facilities movement, because that's what this is all tied to, is there's this arms race in college football to build the newest and best facilities, and the TV contracts are obviously so closely intertwined with that, and the SEC and Big Ten have benefited so greatly from being able to just say, all right, here's a $50 million check. I guess we can upgrade this. I guess we can upgrade that. And so you're right in that it's weird that it hasn't come to fruition in other conferences, but, I mean, it has to before long, right? I mean, the model is there. Everything is there for anybody to be able to do this and succeed, I would think.
See, I'm actually not so sure about that, and I'm glad you brought up the Longhorn Network. That's the one thing I forgot to mention previously. You know, 5-6 years ago, that thing launches. I forget exactly when, but I think it's been about half a decade or so. That was in an environment where, you know, Comcast is making money hand over fist, and so is DirecTV, and so is Dish Network. And you had all these individual schools saying, let's just have our own programming, and we'll make every penny we possibly can. We'll sell every second of every day, and we'll do great. And Texas was probably the good place to start that, because not only do they have the football background, but soup to nuts, that's a fantastic athletic program, tons of money, alums all over the country with super deep pockets, and it hasn't really worked. They can't get it on enough TV sets at home. The programming is very average. The advertising hasn't sold very well. It's not providing the money for the school that they anticipated. I'm a Florida State guy. I remember when the Longhorn Network got off the ground, I had Florida State fans writing me saying, hey, it's time for the Seminole Network. And I said, look, I know you think Florida State is a big deal, and it is. It is a quote-unquote national brand, but they can't carry their own television station nationally. Absolutely no chance. And that spins me to the ACC Network, which was the idea was finally brought public, I believe, 2 Julys ago at ACC Media Days by Commissioner Swofford, where I believe that they plan to launch 2019. It's a programming initiative with ESPN. They're going to, of course, want to mirror what the SEC network is, but the environment for television has changed drastically the last couple of years. This is a cord-cutting environment. This is a Netflix environment. This is an Amazon Prime environment, and you can get all the TV you want, whether it's on an app or a smart TV or just watching on your phones or your tablets. This is not sitting on your couch and pulling up your Comcast box and scrolling through the networks anymore. I wonder if the ACC network ever even gets off the ground. I think it's possible it never even happens.
With ESPN making all these cutbacks, that was a big topic of discussion when they made all those layoffs over the summer was, okay, what's going to happen to the ACC network? Is it still going to be able to launch? Is it going to work in this current climate? And we just don't know. I mean, we don't know what this future looks like with now things like, I know YouTube has its own streaming service that's starting this year that we're going to see the effects of across college football and, Amazon. And there are other just streaming devices that are going to be, that are going to kind of factor into this whole cable bubble that people are waiting for to just burst. And it's kind of weird, too, to think about. I think about this a lot when I'm watching, like, an 11 o'clock game on, Big Ten or SEC Network or something like that. I always think to myself, so wait, there was a time when games just weren't on TV, and if it was on ESPN or it was on ABC, we just didn't watch it. It's crazy to think that was just, that was 10 years ago, essentially. And we as college football fans have adapted so much to wanting to watch every single game and wanting there to be access to it, and when there's not, people kind of throw a fit and people kind of freak out on Twitter. And it's interesting to see that the way that the market has shifted so dramatically since the start of the launch of the Big Ten Network, and it's such a different climate now. It's a good point. I don't know if the ACC Network is going to get get up and running. I really don't know. And ESPN's funding is going to be a big question mark as to whether or not they're going to be able to make that thing thrive like the SEC network. But yeah, it plays a part in what these schools are going to be able to do long term. So I guess just stay tuned when it comes to that stuff.
Connor, I know I'm older than you are, but I believe you're old enough to remember that back in the 80s or maybe even the 90s when schools were getting in trouble with the NCAA for recruiting violations or whatever they may happen to be, the punishment periodically from the NCAA was a television ban. Your games can't be on television. That sounds so caveman compared to the environment we have now. You can watch almost any high school game in the country you want right now on a streaming device somewhere. It's just incredible how fast this thing has been put in the microwave and changed. Again, I don't know if the ACC network ever happens. And, okay, it's 2017 right now. It's a cord-cutting environment, as I mentioned. Would you really be that shocked, honestly, that shocked, if 12 months from now, the Conference USA makes an announcement that they've made an exclusive deal with Crackle and all their games are going to be on Crackle and go get your Roku box or your Apple TV. That's how you're going to watch our games now.
I can believe it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know, I think it was Campus Insiders that had a deal with the Mountain West, and there are games that are being broadcast on Twitter now. I mean, that's the climate. It's not just the big boys competing for these rights deals. There are so many other competitors, and people realize that, and cord cutters even realize this too, that live sports are what people want to watch. I mean, for people that get rid of cable, the toughest thing to get rid of, at least in terms of my demographic, is live sports. I mean, that's all we want to watch on cable, and we have it. We want to be able to go to these different channels. So yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. This could definitely change in the next, even in the next year or so. It's probably going to be drastically different if we're having this conversation at this time next year.
Well, not to mention the fact that you're the demographic that all the advertisers want, handsome young men, correct?
Did you just throw out my let's go on the record. I am not affiliated with any party. Let's take that back. Let's off the record. We don't want to start that conversation. No. Let's just rewind on what was just said there.
All right, sounds like a perfect time to hit the road. What do you say?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, that was Connor O'Gara, ladies and gentlemen. Remember to follow him on Twitter, at CJ O'Gara. You can also follow me, at Saturday JC. And thank you for listening to the Saturday Down South podcast. Special thanks to our friends at WDAE here in Tampa, as well as our sponsor, TicketCity.com. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe on iTunes and all the other outlets available to you. Be sure to give the show a rating as well. We always appreciate that. My name is John Crist, and for All SEC, all the time, be sure to visit SaturdayDownSouth.com.